Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2008 documentary film Pray the Devil Back to Hell, directed by Janie Redeker. The members of the panel will include Palma Strand, Associate Professor of Law at the Creighton University School of Law, Jackie Font Guzman, the Director of the Werner Institute at Creighton, and Jay Carney, Assistant Professor of Theology in the Creighton University Department of Theology. This program, presented in collaboration with the Werner Institute, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, February 27, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Pray the Devil Back to Hell was nominated for several awards and was the winner for Best Documentary Feature at the 2008 Tribeca Film Festival. A civil war had been raging for years between the dictatorship of the Liberian president and the rebels who called themselves the Lurd. The Lurd wanted to overthrow the government. They terrorized the people in the country through killings, rapes, dismemberment, and destruction. They were becoming more powerful as they closed in on the capital city, Monrovia. One unlikely heroine is inspired by a dream to bring Christian women together to start a peace movement. She begins with her own church and asks that all women from all churches are brought together. At one meeting, a Muslim woman goes up to the podium to address the church and tells them that she is moved by what they are doing and that Muslim women need to be brought into the peace movement. This was a cause that transcended all differences. With this extraordinary mission, the women dressed in plain white clothes and covered their heads as a way to shed any differences of class or religion among them. They decided to make peace signs and sit in at the fish market where the Liberian president drove past every morning. He refuses to acknowledge them for weeks. The women finally get to present their mission statement to the president, as well as demand peace talks between the government and the rebels. The women do not just hand things over to the men, however. When the peace talks finally come to fruition, a delegate group goes to Ghana to ensure that a resolution is made. The first 2 weeks, no progress is made. The rebel warlords are just demanding future positions in the government and access to the country's resources. The Liberian president had already fled back to Liberia when Sierra Leone tries to indict him for war crimes. The women's growing anger and frustration lead them to stage a sit-in. They block all the doors and windows, preventing anyone from leaving the peace talks without a resolution. Trapped with no food and water, the talks turn serious. Finally, a resolution is signed. The UN peacekeepers move in, and the Liberian president is exiled to Nigeria. The women understood that they could not rely on anyone else to make sure that the resolutions are implemented. They also realize, seeing the UN only creating chaos, that to ensure full disarmament in the country, they would need to step in, forgive their perpetrators, and convince each one of them that they would be accepted back into the community. The truly final mission for the women was to ensure a democratic election and elect a woman into the office of the presidency. The power of the women prevails. The first female president is elected. The women can finally go home, mission accomplished. Peace reigns in Liberia. Here now to introduce the program is Brian Hansen, Assistant Director of the Werner Institute.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Brian Hansen. I'm Assistant Director of the Werner Institute. We're a master's degree program at Creighton University that does cover a lot of different subjects. We're interested in conflict engagement, dialogue, helping people resolve issues that are causing challenges in their life all around. And this movie tonight is something that we are really excited about. If you haven't seen this movie, it's a few years old, but it's really amazing. It tells just a very striking story of something that happened surprisingly in contemporary society, but it really depicts what some very strong women can do to overcome some very difficult situations in a nonviolent manner. And there's a lot of relation, and we're looking forward to a wonderful dialogue. We have Jackie Font Guzman, Palma Strand, and Jay Carney, all from Creighton University, to talk about, you know, how can we take what we've seen on the screen and relate it to even what's happening in our world, even though we definitely are not facing the same things that they may be facing, but the processes can be very, very relevant.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Jackie Fawn, and I'm director of the Werner Institute at the School of Law, Creighton University, and faculty there as well. And I'm with two of my colleagues, Palma Strand from the law school and Jay Carney from the Department of Theology, and I'll let them introduce themselves in a little while. Before we start, I do want to thank, again, FilmStreams and Rachel for continuing us to have us here, being able to work with the community and our students, and we're grateful that you're here as well. So I'm going to, you want to maybe briefly say something a little bit about each other, and then we can start? Or just go ahead.
Well, I'm Palma Strand. As Jackie said, I'm in the law school and the Werner Institute, and maybe I'll just say a little bit about kind of why I'm here. I'm here because my area of interest and kind of focus is social movements, civic engagement, and kind of broad scale conflict, I guess.
And my interests are in the culture, cross-cultural perspectives, and gender issues, and I'm very much interested in how people can destabilize, use systems to actually achieve non-violent processes to achieve peace. And so that's sort of my interest. And Jay?
Yeah, my name is Jay Carney. I teach in theology, and one of the big focuses of my work is in modern Christianity in Africa. And I'm also particularly interested in processes of social reconciliation and the kind of theology that underlies social reconciliation.
So I think we're going to each say maybe a few minutes worth of kind of comments and observations from our own perspectives, and then open it up to the floor for questions. So there are three things that I want to say. One is that, you know, this is the second time I've seen the film, and I have to say, this time really as a mother, it really struck me how powerful that powerful of a theme that is in the movie, and how powerful that was in this movement, that that these were women who came together, you know, as mothers, and that's one of the first things that Lema Bowie says, but, you know, as sisters, aunts, grandmothers, etc., and that kind of common human experience and bond really brought these women together across religious lines, which was a big, you know, is a not that they lost that religious identity. You know, they were still Muslim, they were still Christian, but there was this kind of deeper human experience. The second thing that really struck me is just the power of a single individual, and not that, you know, obviously these were women were working together, but, you know, the power of Lema Bowie to kind of say, you know, with her background, she was a social worker, so she had some training in trauma, and you know, wasn't just kind of starting from nowhere, but to not just say I can't do anything, but to actually, you know, say I can do something. I'm going to start my church, and the ripples kind of went out. And, you know, one of the things that really struck me when I saw the movie this time is the sex strike, and how it sounds a little bit corny, but in some ways what that does is it empowers all women. It sort of takes it out to every single woman who has a relationship and says, you know, engage with this issue, because this is an issue about you and what's happening in the country. And then the third thing that I just want to highlight is how intentional the women here were about not being out for kind of government positions and government power. And, you know, they said at the very first, you know, we're not going to say we want this or we want that. We're just going to say we want peace. And it wasn't until the very end that that they got, involved in the political campaign that eventually led to Ellen Sirleaf being elected president of Liberia and being the first woman elected head of state, I guess, in mm-hmm. Africa.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I agree with, I mean, all of your intake in terms of, you know, what that power of one, that individual, but also I think it's amazing the tension that you see in the film between, you know, a very overpowering structure that could be paralyzing, and yet how and how they
speaking of overpowering,
yeah, overpower, here it is, and that tension between the potential to be totally disempowered and agency, and how they manage to focus on the positive and say, I can do something. And then the way they use the reframing of, I'm not against anything, I'm really just for peace. And I think that was pretty powerful, because I think, in my opinion, that's what allowed all of this group of people to come together, because they could not maybe potentially be in agreement as to maybe what government they were going to take in place, what is the difference between, you know, people wanting money, like they say in the movie, or some wanted, you know, some are saying it's lack of resources, issues of different ethnic groups. It's, she takes it away from that by just using a framing of, we're really not against anything, we're just pro-peace, and that's going to be our focus, and we're going to stay on message. The other thing that I think is pretty amazing also, the consistency of this woman and the resiliency to, I mean, day after day after day, being able to have that power to be at the same place constantly, nonstop. And they mentioned, this is not an event, this is a process. And just when they thought, okay, we accomplished the mission, Taylor is no longer in power, they see that things are not going the way that they want, and then they continue. And I think part of that rhythm that they sort of like, they would reflect, and it wasn't this random, we're just going to go there and protest, but they were very clear and intentional about what they wanted to do. And I'm also, not only the whole sex strike, but also how they used some cultural norms to be able to really catch the attention of individuals and the groups and say, we better get going. They not only managed to get the attention of locally, but internationally. So how does effect of just starting with those who supposedly had the least power, which were the women within the society, they managed to have this impact by just staying on mission, their consistency, that passion, not only locally, but internationally, which at the end was a real help in terms of them achieving what they wanted to achieve. So overall, I think that those using those systems and saying, we're just not going to allow this to happen anymore. We're going to use whatever is within our cultural norms, our power of having that group, and they gain the respect even of the child soldiers. And I think that's also going to that motherly, like they're not vindictive. Okay, so I'm angry at them because of all they did, but then they also say, but I recognize their victims as well. And so we cannot really move forward unless we're trying to forgive them and reincorporate them into the society that we want, which is this democratic country, to move forward. So I think those were pretty powerful moments. Jay?
Yeah, I just wanted to focus a little on the rhetoric of peace in the film. One, as a theologian, it reminded me that something that Jesus always talks about that we sometimes forget or overly individualize is peace. He's always talking about bringing peace. Even in the resurrection, it's always bringing the gift of peace. But in the film starts with Charles Taylor saying that he's going to reconstruct the minds of his people. This is a very dangerous thing. This is a totalitarian throughout time, want to reconstruct the minds of the people. But it occurred to me by the end of the war, when you'd have almost 15 years of war, that the women of Liberia in many ways are doing a similar thing. They're trying to reconstruct people's minds and their relationships. And I feel like they do this in the opposite of Taylor, where he's going to do this through war rather through peace and even the rhetoric of peace. And they, as Palma said, it reframes even religious identities. And so, again, these lines that have never really been crossed, and they even say that people have never gathered, the goal of peace brings people together in a way that they were not together before. And even this, in a sense, offers a religious witness that I think is often not there, but was incredibly important, this kind of unity. It reframes the political narrative, even some of the warlords saying, you know, Taylor will only listen to the gun. There's only one way to talk to this man. We have the righteous cause, he doesn't, etc. We're going to get power, all this language of power over and over. But the language of peace just kind of changes that narrative. And even, I love this line at the end, I think this is from the Nigerian minister, but, you know, challenging even on this issue of masculinity, saying, if you are a real man, you wouldn't be killing your people. So the language of peace even reframes gender in a very, very important way. And then finally, just peace rhetorically is a verb, and that kept coming back to me in this film, that peace is not a noun, it's a verb. You see the line at the end talking about peace as a process, not an event, this ongoing sense. even the action of peacemaking itself leading to direct civil disobedience and action with the women taking over the peace hall, which is a great irony. Here's the peace hall where nothing is actually happening. And then the disruption of the peace hall actually brings real peace and real peace talks. The language at the end, you know, we made Liberians bold. We made them step out. We did the unimaginable. I mean, literally the idea of peace isn't even imaginable at all, but it's the actions of these women that actually make the unimaginable possible. And so I was just struck also just by the cooperative nature of this, so that all of these women are gathering together, and like the collective whole is much greater than the sum of its parts. And there are other actors involved, international actors, other leaders. And so it also reminded me, in terms of peace being an action, that we're all called to this kind of action, and to recognize that we're not, it's not a messiah complex, to bring it back to theological language, but rather that you make your contribution. And I thought of this is a necessary contribution. It's a small one, but without it, this the peace building, this community doesn't go forward. So thank you.
I think now we'd like to open it for questions or comments.
I just had a couple of comments. One was, it struck me when they were talking about using withholding sex as a vehicle of gaining some power. I wondered how many of those women actually encountered abuse within their own home for having withheld sex from their husbands. So that's just one thing that really struck me, is how brave that was for those women to do that, to risk themselves on a personal level as well as on a broader level. The second thing is, I don't know how many of you saw the PBS last night, the news hour, but there was a program on Kenya and on the upcoming election in Kenya on Monday. And just so happened that I was spent most of 2011 in Kenya, in Kibera, which is a slum in Nairobi, with a woman there who was on that program last night. And I have no idea how much she was influenced by these women, but in 2007, 2008, they had quite a bit of violence after the elections in Kenya, mm-hmm. and over 1,000 people were killed, many of them in Kibera, in this slum. And this woman organized a group of women in that community to walk down the streets in the middle while people were being macheted all around them to protest against the violence there. And out of that came a group of women who continued to organize themselves to promote peace within each of their little regions within Kibera. So now, as it's getting close to the elections on Monday, they've organized themselves again to try and get the young people to give up their weapons. They've been collecting weapons, machetes, and so on, in fear that there's going to be violence again on Monday. And so those women, again, are organizing to try and get the youth to remain peaceful through it.
One of the things, and I don't know how much it's related, but one of the things that really has always struck me about these kind of these movements and is that they often build one on another. And in Kenya, Wangari Maathai and the Greenbelt movement, Wangari Maathai was, for those of you who don't know, was she started a movement in Kenya that was based on, I guess it was a response to the desertification of the land, and had to do with planting trees, basically, to kind of restore the soil and some of the water. And it was not just about planting trees; it was about empowering women to plant trees and to cultivate trees throughout the country. And you know, I just wonder. I mean, I don't know, but I wonder if the work that Wangari Maathai did with respect to women and the Greenbelt movement in Kenya is something that then was something that the woman that you're talking about, or the women you're talking about, could build upon.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, I'm not sure regarding your comment of how many of these women maybe suffered violence or not by taking the action of deciding to engage in what they call a sex strike. But I do know it is pretty common in settings, and in Ireland it certainly did happen as well when they were protesting, that the use of your body as an instrument of rebellion. And so it happens in many shapes or form. It could be by deciding not to eat, like Gandhi did that as well also. So there's something about using your body as an instrument of agency as ways of calling attention to protests. And so I see this as another way of using, because that is the one thing you can have control over, and that it's more immediate. And so no one can really take that away from you in that sense. They can exercise violence upon you, but then you have that control. So I don't know if any of this woman, they don't say in the film, and I don't really know, you know, if that is something that they may or may not have suffered, but it was certainly a message to the man. It, you know, you're either with us, or, you know, if you really, you need to be with us, or if not, you're against us by inaction. So just sitting there and not doing anything is not helpful. It's actually helping them. And so that's their way of sending that message, which it seems like it was ended up being very powerful.
I was wondering about the role of religion specifically within this film, and then applying that to change within the United States. It seemed that both the mosque and the church were very critical as venues for bringing the women together and creating a quick and fast network for the word to spread. So how critical do you think the role of religion or religious places or buildings are for change to happen? And within the United States, would that be as critical?
I guess I better start.
You're the theology guy.
Our religion expert here.
It's like my father will say, you want to lead grace? Isn't that what they taught you in school? You know, so I think in Africa, for sure, I mean, religious communities are of central social importance. I think in a way that surpasses most of America. Having said that, particularly in America, I think religious communities are still very, very important. And I think particularly in minority communities, also particularly in rural areas as well. I think sometimes the challenge is that, again, even the language, for instance, of peace and the social dimensions of much of the Gospels or other areas are not actually discussed in any real way. So things are kind of either individualized or just, in a sense, the meat's taken off the bones, in a sense. And then obviously these divisions run through the church. I mean, and through the mosque, for that matter. And, you know, Taylor, I think, sort of embodies that. In some ways, Taylor is a good example of very bad theology. But this, you know, this idea, I don't want to be here. All right? I didn't choose to be here. But there's one man who protects me, you know. And this, but I mean, you have that a lot of that kind of rhetoric. So I think that's partly where I think rhetoric and language is important and how we talk about these things in our communities. But I think one thing in this film that's a good lesson is that the problems that are happening all over are seen as a religious challenge for these communities. And I think sometimes in America if you're in that neighborhood or in that community, you see it that way, and churches can be very, very involved in that grassroots work. But say you live in a different part of Omaha, or you're living off in another community, that's not your issue, and you know, people, that sense of solidarity is not always there. So,
and I think it's also interesting, two things on what you're mentioning, Jay. And one is that I do know in other areas of Africa you're mentioning, and you're certainly more familiar because you've done research in some of, you know, in that continent. But I know in Zimbabwe, for example, it was instrumental for the rebels. The way they actually ended up winning was by adopting the rituals that the locals were using and their mediums. And so they went through those same processes and engaged in the same prohibited conducts and what they could eat or could not eat. And then once they started that process, everywhere throughout the country started supporting them and bringing them in, which was a different approach that the rebels did not maximize on that strategy here. On the contrary, they, you know, started beating this woman and raping them and killing their husbands. And the other thing that I find interesting that you were just mentioning now with Taylor is how really the same discourse is used on different ends. Because she starts by saying, I received a dream. And there's almost this implication, you know, and I go to church. And it's like, she's not clear about it, but it's like someone is telling me that this is what I need to do. And she goes to church, and then she prays there, and that's how all this sort of starts. And so that same message, I am here because I'm getting some sort of message from God to do this, is exactly the same discourse that Taylor is using. I am here because God sent me. And so I think one of the great strategies of this woman are that they step away from all of that religion, you know, dogmatism and say, let's just focus it on peace again. Let's just sort of not go there all the way. And it helps not polarize the controversy of Muslims versus Christians versus it becomes all of us in favor of peace.
I had to look at this from a slightly different perspective, unfortunately. I don't have a very good sense of geography or world history, but I found it pretty interesting that since probably the Age of Enlightenment, some of the most profound social justice movements have been women. In America in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you have Mother Jones, who used a classic, "You will not stop me because I know you." The example was used in this film, "You should never, ever see your mother naked." Mother Jones used a tactic similar to that, and I find it interesting that this is the fourth or fifth social justice movement that's happened totally centered around the mother figure. And I was curious if you agree or find that to be an obscure look.
Well, I didn't really, you know, I mean, I don't have like a history of mother social movements in my head, but, you know, and obviously that was the first thing I said, because that, I think that is a really powerful identity. And I think that when people tap into that, when women tap into that, obviously, and then feel empowered to act upon that, then I think it's amazing what happens. But, you know, one of the things when we were talking a little bit about this movie before, and I just want to emphasize it because Jay mentioned it a little bit, is this kind of question, this funny question of what happens in the you know, over the course of this about gender roles and how, you know, what really starts this going is this really strong kind of maternal, this is not something that is acceptable. And then by the end of the movie, there's this redefinition of what it means to be masculine without a redefinition of what it means to be feminine. And there's, for me, there's this really kind of, like, where does that lead you? And I don't have an answer. But I think all of those things are so deep-seated in us that they're really, really powerful. It's not an answer. It's just a thought.
But I think the whole concept of, you know, what is gender, you know, what's woman, what's male, what's appropriate, it is reconstructed here, and it's based, it's tied in with your performance. So it's, I mean, you're not a real man because you're not doing what real men should do. And so the focus is not some, you know, it's really on what is my performance that I should be following with the given gender and how that's being define and redefine in this whole process. So I think when they're at the end, when they are or somewhere in the middle, where they were at the peace hall and the peace accord, that whole interaction that Jay was describing, you know, you're not acting like a man, and in a way, it's reshaping this kids with guns. You know, that's being a man. And by the end of the movie, there's the same kid saying, "I respect this mother figure. Yeah. I'm going to change my role." So you know, what makes us the gender we are? It's an interesting aspect that I think surfaces in the movie. Is it based on my actions and my performance, and how that is redefined depending on the context and where I'm at?
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, there's some great examples in other parts of Africa, and I'd particularly encourage you to study the work of Maggie Baron-Kitse in Burundi and her work with Maison Shalom, which is a network founded in the midst of the Burundian Civil War, where she was almost killed, and but now encompasses over 30,000 children. But she's become, actually, I was with her last month, but she's become this kind of regional figure, but in a similar way, kind of started grassroots and now is uplifted. I think what's a little bit interesting about this story is the transition from, you might say, the social to the political with Ellen Shirley Johnson being elected. Yeah. And what does that mean? Because even figures like Maggie Baron-Keitzer, Angelina Atium, and Uganda also have been very, very kind of reluctant about getting into politics. And that's still, and then even in cases, for instance, in Rwanda, where there, you have a majority female parliament, and there's been a lot of talk of it, there's still a sense, well, that's not actually real, and these women have no power, and all the power is really with the president. So I think that's a case, and you don't really see it in the film because it stops, but with Ellen Johnson's witness, how does that also change the conversation of gender and leadership?
Which is another redefinition of gender, because up till now, the woman's role was being motherly, and protesting through you know, nonviolence movements, but staying away from politics and the power, because that was reserved for men. So even there, we see a gender role at the end that it's assumed when she wins, the first woman that actually manages to become the president of a.
And it's actually interesting. She, you know, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf didn't really come out of this movement. Mm-hmm. She'd been in the government before. She'd gotten kind of on the outs with Charles Taylor. I think she was briefly in prison or something. She went into exile. She was out of the country. She's a generation older than not than all of the women, obviously, but. There's a different relationship there of, and I think Jackie's point is really well taken of, you know, she's kind of in this government, more kind of masculine role, and the women in the movie are really playing a more traditionally, feminine role. And yet they complement each other.
Yes. I'd like to ask, a question about kind of moving into the rebuilding part on this and the things that we have as societies learned since these events that might help that. I remember hearing somebody talk about how the grandmothers, when these young men came back and were returned to their village and had to reintegrate in those villages where when they were 10 years old or so, they were little boys and taken away and became all these, committed all these atrocities. And then they were taken back to their villages and there was some resistance, some difficulty. It was hard basically to forgive them for what they did. And as I understand it, some of the grandmothers really were significant in playing a role in saying that we need to love them and we need to keep them and integrate them. And they did. They made that happen somehow. And I'm wondering what has happened in our knowledge about how that forgiveness process works and if you could address that at all.
Seems like I'm the one answering this question. I actually think that the process, and you see it a lot in the truth and reconciliation processes that have been happening throughout, and not only in the African continent, but other countries as well, where there's this distinction between obviously forgiveness and reconciliation. And so, you know, forgiveness more that letting go of, you know, I need to move on and I need to sort of, what happened, I'm not going to defend it, I'm not going to justify it, but I just really need to let go so I can move on with my life. And then you see the steps that I think is what's happening in the movie, that they not only do that, but they're able to reach that phase of reconciliation. And it's like, and that would be more like, let's not only am I going to forgive you, but let's come together and do something. Let's move the country forward. Let's reincorporate you into society. Let's work with you. And she starts saying how, and I'm not sure in what context because the movie's not clear, but it seems like there's some sort of rehab type of camp, because they're all of them are either, you know, are missing an arm or a leg, or as a result of this war. And she says, you know, through working with them, there's a new whole relationship that's happening. And then she starts seeing them as victims and not as perpetrators. And I think that is a common theme in some of the, at least what I've read, for example, in Mozambique with the Civil War, there is a process, and what they did in that country was they used the rituals of their religions to do what they call like a cleansing process, and they would bring all the soldiers and, you know, that used to be the rebels, and these kids, and they would go through all this process, and they called it that healing process. So I think that distinction of, you know, the forgiveness versus reconciliation and the countries that are really able to move forward seem to be the one that can pull that off, which I think says a lot about this countries that we sometimes stereotype as, you know, the third world countries, the ones that are not so developed, the ones that are not so don't have the resources, the people that are, I mean, there tends to be this massive stereotype even in CNN and, you know, when you're watching news and things like that. And yet they are able to do that. And so we try and compare and contrast that maybe with the veterans that come in the United States when they come back and they're trying to be reintegrated into society. And you have issues, like I think in Omaha a few years ago, where they wanted to put it was a center to bring in some of these soldiers so that they could be housed in particular areas, and some of them had, I believe, their addiction issues or you know, severely impaired, and the community protested, I don't want them here because of everything else that's going to happen. So I just, whenever I see that about the news here, there's that contrast between what these countries that are going through this very severe, I mean, really levels of violence that are just incomprehensible at some point, and how yet they're able to have that same level of forgiveness and the capacity to reconciliate. And for me, that's always been a very, you know, a question that has been always in my mind. It's like, wow, you know, and we're supposed to be the more civilized, advanced, you know, country. And so I think that's an interesting tension there. But.
Yeah, just I would just add quickly the question you asked earlier about religious communities. I mean, this is where I think a lot more could be done as well on these issues, particularly the importance of ritual, of the sacred kind of sense of this. And again, I think it happens somewhere, but I just don't see it as much. I mean, an example would be from church history during the crusading period. I usually don't go to the Crusades. Let's talk about the Crusades. That's a great model of religious, you know. But one thing that I think is positive is when Crusaders would come back from these conflicts, a lot of churches would actually ritually kind of cleanse them from, because of the blood they had shed. And even though it was seen as a righteous cause, and we can, of course, protest that today, but it was still seen, no matter what the righteous cause is, they've shed blood, they've been wounded by this, and they need to be healed and brought back in. And you mentioned Mozambique and other places are doing this, but I don't hear Christian churches in this country talking like that about those who've been engaged even in what might be considered righteous violence. So,
I had a question regarding the United Nations, and I don't know, like, how effective they have been in conflict resolution. It just seems to me that when a lot of these issues come up, like, they get together in the Security Council and talk while atrocities and things are going on. And I was just curious as to, you know, your impression of their conflict management process or whatever skills that they use to do that, because for some reason it just seems like it's never really effective and they're always late. And kind of coming at the end of, you know, when a lot of stuff has already happened. And even after that, even when they come in, like, the processes that they put in place don't seem to be really effective. Just as an observation, it seems like grassroots efforts work better than top-down. So, like, when they sit in their Security Council and have all this talk, never really does anything. Usually when an individual or a group starts from the grassroots, that seems to be a little bit more effective. And so is there something wrong with the module that they use in trying to resolve conflicts? Do they need to have, like, more local input in the process country by country? Like, there's no one-size-fits-all that's going to work in a lot of these countries. And it just seems to me like, you know, like, they just have this book strategy. They follow it, and for some reason it just never seems to work, and they're always very late.
I was just to share an anecdote. I was in Central Africa last month, and I was talking with the Congolese Protestant minister, and there's the largest UN force in the world in eastern Congo, 17,000 soldiers deployed in a conflict that gets very little attention. But there was a Rwandan-backed militia that had invaded a local town, and the UN soldiers just didn't do anything. They just stayed in their barracks and let it happen. So I said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, we got everyone together. We talked to all the churches. We got everyone, and we got 100,000 people out in the streets of Bukavu. And we said, they took Goma. They're going to take Bukavu. They're going to have to kill all 100,000 of us. But, you know, and they just sort of massed in the city. But I mean, his sense was also kind of shared your cynicism. Like, all these UN soldiers are here, and all this stuff goes on. But, you know, but I think the point you made about the grassroots and the mm-hmm. connection with that, I mean, I think there's a real value to the UN. And sometimes in this country, there's this, like, UN bashing that goes on. But there are limits to it as well. And I think to connect the top to the bottom is very, very important.
And I think to add to that, I would agree that they usually are late. And again, at the risk of being a little bit too cynical, I think you have to look at in terms of systems thinking as well, that this is not what's happening only in that country. It's all the political interests. It's all the economic interests that's behind that. It's the, quite frankly, the people that are making billions of dollars selling these arms to these rebels and to these countries. It's the so there's a lot of and which happen to be the countries that are in Security Council, the ones that are making the most money, which is, you know, Britain, U.S., France. So there's a lot of vested interests that transcend, you know, what's going on in an individual country. And the perfect example, because it was also made into a very successful movie, was Rwanda, where no one was really paying attention until, you know, there was this massacre after massacre after massacre, and then someone decided to do something. So for me, two things out of the comment that you're making is, one is there are larger forces here that people need to be aware. Yet this movie is a perfect example of how you still retain agency to be able to do something effectively that is positive in a sort of timely fashion, at least in this case. The other thing in terms of the UN, I would agree that what comes to mind is that I think it's the lack of humility. I think it's the posture that we are the experts in conflict, or we are the experts in whatever is going on, and I'm going to go into your country and tell you what you need to do. And the reality is that not always they tap into the wisdom of local people to ask them, how do you usually deal? I mean, these are people that have been dealing with violence way before the UN got there. So how have you been coping and dealing? What are the no one's things to ask those questions. They just assume I'll come in because I am the expert. And so I think it's a combination of lack of humility and there is a larger structure out there that we need to address, and it's possible, but it's present. It's not something that it's, you know, that we can necessarily ignore.
And I'm going to put on my lawyer's hat here for just a minute. You know, I think the UN is not, you know, it's not an international state. It's not something that everybody's bought into. It comes in, you know, to a certain extent when it's invited. You know, there's a lot of politicking. And, I mean, I certainly think it has its place. And I certainly think that when you have movements inside the country, the, you know, outside forces, as we saw in this movie, are absolutely helpful in terms of sort of, you know, in a sense, squeezing in the middle. But I think that sometimes we want more from the UN than it really is kind of set up to offer at this point or to provide.
Just a couple of comments on what you said, Jackie, and also on your question. Jackie, you commented that the United Nations approaches these situations with a lack of humility, and that was obvious in the film and the disarming in the disarmament scene. Some critics have gone so far to call it, you know, to maybe tell it like it is, and says that it's not only a lack of humility, there's a colonizing effect mm-hmm. of, you know, we are the experts coming in from outside and we'll tell you how to run your country. And the UN often sometimes tends to stay for a while, and there are benefits associated, and that sometimes it causes as many problems as it solves, even with the best of intentions. And nothing works quite like grassroots effects, as that showed. There's a large body of scholarship. I'm not talking so much about the conflict management of let's say UN troops on the ground, but of general intervention in conflicts through mediation. That the UN is the body that's called in to mediate in international conflict. This is the work of Jacob Berkovich, and who studied mediation in international contexts in wars and civil wars around the world. Discovered the UN is the body that is most often called in, it's, as opposed to other global actors, NGOs, private individuals, or regional actors like the European Union or the Organization of African States. And the UN also has the lowest batting record, so to speak, of success in mediation efforts. Maybe that's because it gets called into the, you know, to the lousiest cases, and maybe it's just because, you know, that needs to be improved or connected to the grassroots once again. And just in terms of your general question of what can the United Nations do, and maybe this is not helping. That's what inspired me to ask for the microphone. I heard Lema Gabawi speak a few months ago, and I thought maybe I could bring that voice into the room. Not that I could ever. She is larger than life in person. The big screen does not do her justice. She's larger than the screen. And she said that she was recently invited by the Secretary General to present of the United Nations to present to the General Assembly on the, I don't remember what it was, the fifth or the sixth anniversary of the peace accord, and she was asked to address the General Assembly. And she said, no, why would I want to? She said, I'm not going this year. Every year they invite me, and I come, and I speak, and they chatter about it, and nothing happens. And why would I want to go and address the General Assembly when I could stay home and help some woman take care of her children or make peace in her community? I'm staying in Liberia this time. I wish I could say that like she does, but I'm glad that I could even bring her words into the room. Thanks.
That's great.
This is also the second time I've seen this film. The first time I saw it pre-Werner Institute program, and this was post-Werner Institute program. So I just wanted to make a couple of observations about things that I've learned, which is a credit to the Institute. The first thing is I noticed a strategy, and please help me because I can't remember what the name of it is, but you know, when the conflict goes so far that there's no turning back. So that was my first observation, is that they got enough buy-in, they went far enough with it, there was really no turning back. I mean, they would have been killed. I mean, they if they had pulled back and went back to their camps and whatnot, they probably would have lost more life. And they were so far in, they had to keep going. And the second thing is also on the forgiveness piece, present, you know, on the South African conflict with Mandela and Tutu, they made that, they talked about that, they made it a present, you know, component of the conflict. And yes, that is not present in a lot of West type conflicts. It's remarkable in a way, you know. So that struck me like right away when I heard them talk about the forgiveness piece, that has to be present. It's hard, but it has to be present.
Probably just have about a minute if you have any concluding remarks.
I think the movie, I guess I can sum up something, you know, what we've talked here is that if I were to summarize it is how much power this woman had by not having any power. They were perceived to be, I mean, it's a paradox, they were the powerless, so no one was paying attention to them. And by the time they started paying attention to them, it had grown, it was larger than themselves, and now they couldn't stop it. So I wonder if Charles Taylor would have acted this differently if it were have been a group of men or people that he perceived as powerful. Maybe he would have squashed them right there the first day, and then maybe it would have been a whole different story. But by not having power and just, you know, this is just a whole bunch of women that are there that are just protesting in this park, well, you know, in this fish market, he just let it slip too long, and then there was no way back for him. So I think there is that paradox going on in the movie that, you know, not having power can be pretty powerful.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, even within the religious communities, they're very clear that most of these women do not have power within their religious communities as well, which is not necessarily a good thing. But at the same time, they work on their own leaders there, and there's a kind of bottom-up effect on that as well. And I think sometimes that's a very important lesson, that they aren't wholly disempowered even mm-hmm. within their own religious communities, and that partly by taking action collectively, so...
Which actually kind of goes back to your point, which is that mm-hmm. if you're not in the channels of power, the way you exercise power is through, you know, the outside grassroots movement. And so maybe it's not coincidental that there are these social justice movements led by women.
All right. Yeah, Palma, Jackie, Jay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2008 documentary film Pray the Devil Back to Hell, directed by Ginny Redeker. The members of the panel have included Palma Strand, Associate Professor of Law at the Creighton University School of Law, Jackie Font Guzman, the director of the Werner Institute at Creighton, and Jay Carney, Assistant Professor of Theology in the Creighton University Department of Theology. This program, presented in collaboration with the Werner Institute, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, February 27, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Molly Welch, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.